And good morning and welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We have two topics for you this morning. As usual, we'll talk in the first part of the program with about space security. And we have guests, one from the university and one who is here visiting. In the second hour, an interesting story of exploration from the late 19th century. As we talk with Alec Wilkinson, he is a reporter at the writer at the New Yorker magazine and has a very interesting new book that's titled The Ice Balloon, which was about this attempt in 1897 by a Swedish explorer to find the North Pole literally by flying over it in a balloon, which turned out not to be successful, but we'll give you the story later on. And there's also another story we need to tell here this morning, and that's the story of public broadcasting and how it is that it works. And the idea is pretty basic. We are here spending some time on the air asking for your financial support, and we're just starting. And we set a goal, and we hope that we can make $60,000 in listener support. Now, that maybe seems like a big chunk of money, but when you break it down, it actually isn't. Not if we get the support of all of the folks who are listening. So what we're asking you to do is be one of 400 people. That's another goal that we've set. 400 folks to give us a call, 217-244-9455. You can do it right now, or you can go online at willpledge.org. Either way you do it, your support is very important to the work that we do and the programs that you enjoy. And here sitting in the studio with me this morning will be Dave Teal. He's the program director for WILL-TV.
And good morning. Great to be here. And, want to say thank you before we get into the show proper to our partner, Common Ground Food Co-op, because for every pledge of support made to WILL today, they will contribute the cost of 8 meals to the Eastern Illinois Food Bank. So, you know, we offer some different things here this morning. Some great programming, of course, interesting topics, and, of course, you can help feed some hungry people in your community. These are a couple of great reasons to support WILL right now. We hope you'll call 217-244-9455 or go online to willpledge.org, and we definitely say thank you when you do that.
Okay, well, we'll talk some more about supporting the station as we go along, and we'll now get into the topic that we have here for the first part of the show. Space is really quite large, obviously, but the part that human beings use so far is actually rather small, and it is a territory that a growing number of nations have made some claim on, making it increasingly difficult to balance the interests of those nations that are already in space with those looking to move into space. In this part of the show, we'll be talking about space security, and we have two guests. Bharath Gopalaswamy is visiting assistant director in the program in Arms Control, Disarmament, and International Security here at the University of Illinois. Before coming here to ACTIS, he was a researcher at the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute's Arms Control and Nonproliferation Program. Also joining us here in the studio is Victoria Sampson. She is now the Washington Office Director for the Secure World Foundation, where she is involved in looking at, studying, talking about issues that have to do with space security and governance. Before coming into that job, she also served as a senior analyst for the Center for Defense Information in Washington, D.C., and there she was interested in some of the same things, missile defense, nuclear reductions, space security issues. She's visiting the campus. In fact, we'll give a talk at noon today. This is sponsored by the folks at ACTIS, and it's taking place at 356 Armory, and I'm assuming anyone who would be interested should feel welcome to stop by to hear what she has to say. And certainly here in this hour, we would be happy to have questions from listeners. 333-9455 is the number. We have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. And you can send us an email, will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, thanks very much to both of you for being here.
Thank you for having us.
I'm sure that we'll be talking about issues involving militarization of space. And I think probably when people hear space security, that's what they'll think of. And we will talk about that. But there's another set of issues that I think maybe people wouldn't be as aware of. And this has to do with the fact that we've been using space and putting stuff into space for a while now. And there's a lot of stuff in space, in the part of space that's close to the Earth. And it's a problem. And it's a pollution problem. And it's something that I'm now given to understand each actually maybe has a greater potential to be a problem than some of the issues involved with militarization. Maybe let's talk about that. What is the issue now with stuff in space?
Well, when the mankind entered the space age, we weren't really very careful as to what we did with objects on orbit. You know, we let rockets explode. We tested some space weapons. You know, just kind of created large amounts of debris. And the thing about debris, orbital debris, is that it stays up there for a while. Eventually, it'll come back down. But depending how high of an altitude it is, it could be up there for decades, if not centuries, which means that certain orbits that are useful for certain sorts of things get very cluttered very quickly. Mm-hmm. And, you know, at certain orbits, it can be going very fast, maybe up to anywhere, you know, 7 kilometers per second. It's very – so when you have an object even that's small at that speed is going to be incredibly deadly. Right now, the United States military is tracking over 21,000 pieces of debris that are 10 centimeters in diameter, and that's maybe about the size of a softball. But they think that there could be maybe 500,000 ones or even smaller, maybe down to 1 centimeter. And you're thinking, well, my God, so what? But, you know, if something hits you going at 7 kilometers per second, even if it's the size of a centimeter, it can be incredibly dangerous. And if you think about all the money we've spent putting satellites up on orbit, think about people up in the space station, you can understand very quickly how expensive and deadly this could become.
Mm-hmm. First of all, thank you for having us, David, out here. You hit the nail on the head when you talked about the debris issue. Yes, this is a serious issue, and as Victoria explained, some of the physics behind the debris. What she's told you is about the trackable pieces of debris, but there is also this untrackable pieces of debris that are out there. And as I'm echoing with her when she says, depending on the orbit, these debris stay up there for a long time. But yes, that is a big problem, but at some levels, it is also an opportunity for collaboration between nation and cooperation, how to tackle these debris issues together. It's a collective problem. Mm-hmm. For all of us, it's not, well, if the United States caused debris or if China caused debris, it's not only for them. The consequences is for all of us to bear.
Yeah. It seems to me that that's actually an interesting point and perhaps an interesting way to look at it. That is, you know, if one is going to talk about the sustainable use of the resource of space, it's going to mean that everybody, particularly the space-faring nations, to get together. There are competing interests, and I think that some people have said this very thing, is that, well, here's a place you can start where it's likely you can actually get some cooperation going, and that so then perhaps you can use that to build on to, you know, more difficult issues, particularly those when it comes to competition for the use of what, amazingly enough, is a finite resource.
Yeah, I mean, it's very interesting. The idea of tracking debris, the official phrase for it is space situational awareness. Mm-hmm. And so the United States military used to only follow a few satellites that it thought was crucial, saying, okay, we need to make sure that those satellites are doing okay and not that anything, any kind of debris is going to run into it. And then in 2009, you had the Iridium-Cosmos collision, where an active Iridium satellite was hit by an inactive Russian Cosmos satellite. And, you know, didn't do the satellite any good. And at that point, the United States military thought, okay, you know, big sky solution, not so much one we can depend upon anymore. We need to follow all active satellites. So what they do is they actually share information with all owner operators of satellites. This includes Russian satellites. This includes Chinese satellites, you know, British, anyone, with the idea that, and this isn't just doing them out of, this isn't just them doing it out of the goodness of their hearts. The idea is, you know, if a piece of Chinese debris hits a French satellite and creates a mound of debris up there, we're all going to be affected just due to the special physics of the space environment. So it's good to kind of, you know, mitigate the issue and prevent it from becoming a problem if it's just all avoidable.
Mm-hmm.
Very recently, the United States has also inked agreement with France and Australia in space situational awareness. So you have these, you have this concept of space situational awareness creating cooperation between countries from you start with a small engagement, and then you lead on to other areas of cooperation. At Secure World, with ACTUS, we are having a project on discussing cooperation between the U.S. and India in space situational awareness. We are seeing this as a, because this is in the genuine needs of the space environment broadly. Mm. It's not, it's cooperation between two countries, but it's a very scientific need too.
Mm. You talked about the way that an accident can add to space debris. Now, there have been two, not real recently, but two cases where space debris was deliberately created. I mean, that wasn't the idea, but it happened, as both China and the United States deliberately destroyed a satellite. Now, the United States didn't say that this was a demonstration of anti-satellite technology, but it seemed that it was reasonable to assume that it was, and in the Chinese case, I think that it truly was. Now, this was 2001. The Chinese case was, I think, in 2007. The American was in 2008, so that's been a while. Has anything happened more recently, or anything even been contemplated more recently, that would actually end up, through an intentional action, adding to the debris problem?
Well, just to put that in the context, during the Cold War, the United States and the Soviet Union tested anti-satellite weapons 53 times. And back in the Cold War, didn't really pay much attention to debris that was created. The last official anti-satellite test the United States held was in 1985, and it took 17 years for the debris to come back down from that. Now, the Chinese had there was kind of a break between 1985 and 2007. The Chinese had their anti-satellite test, and I think they were very surprised by the amount of international criticism they got by creating large amounts of debris, because they did it at an altitude of about 860 kilometers. That is very popular. It's used by a lot of satellites. It's high enough up that the debris won't come back down very easily. So the United States in 2008, officially, there was a satellite coming down out of control. The United States military said, well, we're going to use missile defense interceptors to take it out. But it's not an anti-satellite test. You know, just coincidentally, it's a year after the Chinese. But the United States, before we shot down that satellite, we said, okay, international community, here's what we're doing. Here's what we're thinking. And we did it at an altitude that was low enough that the debris reorbited fairly quickly. So in 2010, in January of 2010, the Chinese had a quote-unquote missile defense test that shockingly used the same interceptor as the 2007 satellite, anti-satellite test. But this time they kind of learned, I would argue, from the Americans, how you can have an anti-satellite test and not get criticized. They let people know about it ahead of time. They did it at an altitude where the debris would come back down fairly quickly. No problem. So the concern is that maybe there has been a norm of behavior going that if you have an anti-satellite test and you call it missile defense and you do it at an altitude where the debris will come down fairly quickly, it'll be okay.
Yes, I agree with whatever Victoria says. One point, which I would term it as a perverse logic here, is in a way we should be thankful to the Chinese for highlighting the debris issue, because we did not pay much attention to the debris issue that were caused in the last whatever years. The Chinese test, I'm not justifying or advocating the Chinese test. Yes, they caused debris, an incident which is internationally termed irresponsible, and they were also surprised by the amount of the international reaction that they got, and there is sufficient literature to say that they did not expect what this would mean. But they have highlighted the debris problem, and we have to come. And they have also set a norm that nobody conducts an anti-satellite test in that altitude again, which would be disastrous for all the spacefaring nations. Mm-hmm. And all the spacefaring nations, plus all the users of space too, because in the long run, it is a threat to satellites in the long and the short run. What you see going on now is the norm of hitting a bullet to a bullet, satellite, anti-satellite weapon tests being disguised as or missile defense tests or missile defense. There is a common understanding that if you are capable of hitting a bullet with a bullet, if I may put it, then you have an anti-satellite weapon as well as you're advancing your technologies and missile defense too. Hmm. So
Yeah, just to add on to that for what Barath was saying, the concern that I have is that I believe some countries may be using their missile defense programs as a way to develop an anti-satellite capability. India, in particular, is very interested in doing that. They have their attitude is, well, if the Chinese have it, we need to have it as well, just in case. So they've been developing their missile defense systems to kind of develop that kind of capacity. And the concern is, of course, that if you have a lot of people testing anti-satellite weapons, whether or not they're calling it missile defense or what have you, then you run the risk of someone accidentally hitting something they didn't mean to, someone creating large amounts of debris in orbit that they didn't mean to, or just, you know, the traditional proliferation concerns. You know, one country has it, then another country has it, then another country, and then you have a situation where you have perhaps an unstable, unpredictable environment. And depending on how much we require from space just for our culture to function and our national security to function, I think it's definitely worth keeping an eye on.
All right. We're talking this morning about the issue of space security. We have two guests, Victoria Sampson from the Washington office of the Secure World Foundation. She's visiting the campus. We'll be giving a talk at noontime today. Barath Gopalaswamy is also here. He's a visiting associate director at the Program in Arms Control, Disarmament, and International Security. Questions by phone are welcome. Questions by email as well. We'll talk some more after a short break here. We'd just like to remind you that as your local public radio station, WILO relies on your contributions from listeners. More than 40% of our operating revenue comes from folks like you. And that is why a couple times during the year, we sit down here in front of the microphones to try to remind you of that fact and to say, if you would like to be a contributor, and we hope you would, you can call us. You can go online. It's very easy. We'll just take a moment or two. And what you get is the programming that you enjoy every day. So you can give us a call. It's 217-244-9455. Or you can go online to our pledge site, which is Will Pledge, just like it sounds, willpledge.org. Here in studio with me to help deliver the message this morning is Dave Teal. He's our program director of WILO-TV.
And good morning. It's great to be here. And interesting topic, as always. This is a program that requires a considerable amount of effort to prepare. I mean, David has to go out and, you know, he has to actually try to understand all of these topics and do the research. And, you know, and he has certainly a lot of help doing, you know, researching, lining up guests and such. But again, that is all a lot of effort that has to go into producing this program. You know, we could just go over to a satellite feed, just take some national show. But we're here live in the studio talking to people in the community or, you know, people from outside the community who come in, who visit, and we put them on the air. We hope that you support that effort this morning with your pledge call right now at 217-244-9455. As a listener, you're an important part of our community, and we're encouraging you to take the next step and call with your pledge right now.
Yeah. And we, you know, over time, we've been doing this show now actually for 30 years, more than 30 years. We had our 30th anniversary last year, and a lot of people over time have said nice things about the show and what we do. And people have said, well, you know, I learned something. I heard a discussion and I didn't know anything about that. And often people say, I started listening to the program and I heard what it was going to be about. And I said, well, I'm not really sure that I'm particularly interested in that. But often then people will say to me, but, you know, I started listening to that. And then I had to hang in through the discussion. And they at the end, they would say, well, yeah, I discovered something that I didn't know before. If that's the case, and people have told me that many times, and you're not a supporter, I hope that you would change that status from non to yes, because we need the support of as many different people as possible. That's you supply the resources that makes it possible for us to do this show, but everything that we have on this station comes from in large part from folks like you.
And we'd really do appreciate that. We hope you call right now, 217-244-9455. And, of course, you can go online at willpledge.org.
All right.
And we say thanks.
We have a caller here. Others are welcome to join the conversation. You will not be required to pledge. That would be nice, but it's not required. 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. Good anywhere that you can hear us. 800-222-9455. And if you would like to send in a question by email, you may do that as well. It's will-talk@illinois.edu. Here's a caller on our toll-free line up in Piatone, right here, line 4. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. Yes, I frequently pledge to you guys, and congratulations on 30 years. My gosh, I didn't think it was that long, but time flies when you're having fun, right? I want to say the space race, two things. I'm kind of disappointed in NASA in a way. I think development of the space actually could put people back to work. I grew up with it. My father-in-law, I'm from the West Coast. I lived right, my back door was Edwards Air Force Base, so they were always developing things. In fact, right now, I guess I have a friend of mine that works for Burt Rutan, and he's doing stuff for Richard Branson and Burt Rutan, and then some other people. I guess Red Bull is another one. They're doing some space technology out at Mojave Airport in Mojave, California. What I want to say is I know a lot of this discussion is on trying to, you know, for ballistic missiles and, you know, doing all this stuff, but there's two things that really kind of bug me a little bit on this, and I don't understand why we're not doing it. One is the amount of space debris. I know that's up there. It's tens of thousands of stuff floating around. Why somebody doesn't go up there and at least, or NASA or somebody, try to get rid of some of this stuff because you can pick it up. The other one would be, you know, promoting space exploration to the point where, you know, add the jobs to it. Because I know for a fact when the shuttle was going on in my hometown, it was adding 35 to 50,000 jobs at a time. I mean, that's a lot of people. It's like a car manufacturer putting a certain type of vehicle together. You know, and it actually, people don't understand in the Midwest how much NASA has developed to make our everyday life easier. And could you explain some of that and see what, do you think maybe there's a way to push this and try to get people back to work on American-made products instead of some other country doing it for us? So thanks, and I'll get off. Great show, by the way.
Well, thank you. And actually, the first question that the caller asked was in my mind as well, and I would expect that anybody would think, well, okay, if there's a lot of stuff up there and if there's a problem, why can't we go and sweep it up? Is that actually possible?
It is a very good question. Just to be also to clarify, there are some debris mitigation guidelines where the United States and other space agencies around the world say there are certain norms of behavior. We want to make sure we don't create large amounts of debris, you know, by, you know, when a satellite is up there, you have to bring it back down within 25 years to have something to do with it. So there is that. But the idea of removing space debris is difficult because, you know, things are moving very fast. Oftentimes they're very small. We don't know necessarily where they are. I think often when people think about monitoring the objects up on orbit, they think the United States has like a radar screen. You have different objects plugging along and you can see them all as you go. Mm-hmm. It's not like that. Basically what they do is they capture it at one point, you know, they see it at one point, and based on its speed and direction, they say, oh, we think it's going to be here at this time. And they look at there at that time, and if it's there, then their calculations are right. If not, they better redo it. So it's kind of a crapshoot in terms of where things are going to be. But also in terms of removing the debris, it's difficult because it's an extremely tactical challenge to have to handle. NASA has done some studies where they say, okay, if we can remove 5 large pieces of debris per year, then we can kind of get this under control. And the concern, of course, is which 5 pieces those will be. And also, then it becomes the political issue. Most of the trash, well, a good chunk of the trash on orbit is from Russian rockets. So can the United States take down Russian space debris? Would they be okay with it? So, I mean, it's an incredible technical challenge, but I think the policy and the legal challenges are even more, because also you have the issue, well, anything that can take down debris could also take down an active satellite. So how do other countries know that people aren't trying to take out their satellites? So you can see it's one of those issues that is just beginning to be discussed. I don't think it's insurmountable, but definitely takes some thinking.
Mm. Yeah, no, I completely agree. She put it that this is a problem that has a technical, political, and a legal dimension. On technical, yes, as a caller said, it's probably easy for us to say, yeah, why don't somebody go up and do it? Then it comes to the question of who goes first.
Yeah.
What debris does he take out? And not all these countries also have the technological resources at the same level. Okay, I mean, So if it's an Indian debris, if it's a Russian debris, or it's a Chinese debris, you go and ask the Chinese tomorrow, hey, you created these 800, so many pieces of debris by your anti-satellite test. Why don't you go and clean it up? Are they going to buy into that? They would say, no, we will worry about the problem, and the problem actually hits us.
Right. You created most of the debris. You clean up your debris first. We'll clean up ours later. Yeah.
Well, fair enough to say to the Russians and the United States, if indeed we did put most of the debris there, maybe that would be fair for them to say, well, whoever is the responsible for the most stuff should start the cleanup process.
And it's also a prioritizing issue. Countries battle so many other problems. You know, they are going to say, okay, spaces, this is not a problem on our agenda at the moment. We have other important problems to deal with.
Let me ask you about something else that is, in a sense, comes off the other part of the listener's question. It certainly would have been the case that there would have been a time when the only entity that could put something in space would be a government. And in fact, you know, for a long time, there were only two governments that were doing that, the governments of the United States, the governments of the Soviet Union. Well, not only now do we have more nations that are involved in space, but we have private enterprise that's also involved in space, which seems to me like to raise even more the question of how do you regulate the use of this resource? And it seems to be the case that there really isn't a lot of regulation. You know, there's no law of the sea for space. How do we approach this issue?
Well, I mean, that's a very good question. With commercial space getting more prominent, I think it's going to be something that's going to be coming up more and more often. The problem is the FAA is in charge of making sure, you know, you have to notify the FAA when you're going to be launching something. And when something comes back down, you have to clear it with air traffic control. But once it's up on orbit, you're kind of on your own. The International Telecommunication Union says, okay, you have certain orbital slots. You need to make sure your satellite is occupying a certain space. And you have to make sure there isn't any radio frequency interference. That is to say, your satellite isn't broadcasting something that's going to interfere with another satellite. Other than that, go for it. I mean, the only real regulation is that officially you can't put any kind of weapons of mass destruction up on orbit. That's the Outer Space Treaty from 1967. Mm-hmm. But other than that, there's not a whole lot of discussions, which is why there's been a proposed code of conduct, the idea of creating norms of behavior to say, okay, here's how we're going to act just so we know what the rules of the road are. And it's not meant to limit really anyone. It's the idea, well, you know, when I'm driving down the street, I know I have to stay on the right-hand side of the road. That's just a rule that allows me to get to my end state unimpeded and just helps traffic flow better. And the idea with space, at a very gross generalization, it's the same thing.
Yeah. And this, I believe this was something that started with the EU, the code of conduct, and that just fairly recently, I think just last month, the United States said, yes, they would be interested in participating in this. But is this still really just at the talking stage?
Short answer is yes. Yes, I mean, as she said, there is no really a multilateral framework for discussing these space issues. Let me start off from there. Mm-hmm. You have the 1967 Outer Space Treaty, which really prohibits that to nuclear weapons being in space. But beside that, today we don't have a multilateral framework. We have the Committee on Peaceful Uses of Outer Space in Vienna that discusses science and peaceful applications of space. And you have the Conference on Disarmament, which is mandated to discuss the prevention of arms race in outer space, which doesn't really go any far because of various other political problems associated with it. So you say you have these debris issue today, and you say debris can be created by space by anti-satellite weapons testing issue, which is essentially is weaponization of space. You talk this in Geneva, countries go ballistic saying, no, this is...
No pun intended.
No, yeah. No pun intended. No, this is not the place to discuss these issues. You have to discuss it in Vienna. And when you go to Vienna and discuss these issues, they say, this is not for us to discuss. This is for Geneva to discuss. First of all, there is a lack of understanding amongst diplomats and policymakers about what these actually mean. Mm-hmm. So we have to start from there. That is one of the starting points to better educate the policymakers on these issues. You want to add?
Yeah, I mean, I was telling Broth earlier, I met with some staffers of a representative on the Hill just this past week, and they said, well, you know, we don't really like the European Union Code of Conduct because we don't think the Europeans do much in space. They don't need to be writing anything about it. And I thought, oh, my God, the European Space Agency, you know, they're huge investors. They're doing something to Mars. You know, maybe not to the same extent we have stuff up in orbit, but they certainly do have a lot of things there. But I mean, the thing that you run into with in terms of international discussions of space debris and weaponization is that space is so dual use. You know, anything that can be used for military space could also be used for civil space. So it's not like with nuclear weapons where you're pretty sure that's what it's going to be used. It's going to be used for defensive or offensive purposes. With a space weapon, it could be something you're launching something up in orbit that's completely peaceful. And so it's really difficult to have a treaty on this issue. And the international discussions have leaned more towards the idea of regulating behavior as opposed to prohibiting technology, which is where something like a code of conduct would come in handy.
We're talking this hour, Focus, about space security. We have two guests with us, Victoria Sampson, Bharath Gopalaswamy. We'll talk some more after a short break. This is Focus.
Today's programs are made possible by 10,000 Villages at 105 North Walnut in downtown Champaign. 10,000 Villages is celebrating 26 years of trading fairly in Champaign-Urbana, offering eco-friendly handcrafted decor and gift items from around the world. A gift from 10,000 Villages is a gift that gives twice.
This is Focus, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're here weekday mornings, 10 until noon. We have 10 different topics for you every week. In the second hour today, we'll be talking with Alec Wilkinson. He's a staff writer for the New Yorker magazine. We'll be talking about his recent book, The Ice Balloon, which is the story of a Swedish explorer who, in 1897, took off from Sweden with the goal of floating over the North Pole in a balloon. It turned out not to be a success. He was lost. In fact, it was more than 30 years before people really knew what happened to him. Quite an interesting story. We'll have that for you in hour number two. You can check the schedule, find out what we'll do in the days ahead. Also, listen to past programs. You can do all of that by going to our website, which is WILL.illinois.edu. There's something else you can do when you go to our website. It's a slightly different address. But it is possible to go to our website and make a pledge of support to this station. That is willpledge.org. That's our secure pledge site. And over time, I think more and more people have chosen to make contributions that way. Or you can do it the old-fashioned way. You can give us a call, 217-244-9455. Either way, it is real important that we hear from as many people as possible during this effort to raise funds. We'll be doing for a couple of days, not very much time, and we'll try to keep the interruptions down to a minimum. But the message is really important. That is, you make it possible for us to do the programs that you value. A little over 40% of the money for the programs comes from listeners. And we'd like people to be active participants. When you listen to the show, you can be an active participant. You can call in. You can send us an email. Well, another way to be an active participant is to be an actual financial supporter of the programs. That's what we're asking people to do. Here in studio with me is the program director for our TV station, David Teal.
And good morning. It's great to be here. We want to definitely encourage everyone right now to go to your phone. You know, if you can make that the call into the program and, you know, chat with David and our guests, and that's great. But we also need to hear from you at times like this when, you know, we're trying to actually pay for the program that you enjoy every morning here on WILL. We have heard from a couple of callers, and we've actually gotten a web pledge as well. And we would love to be able to add you to that roster this morning at 217-244-9455 or willpledge.org.
You can do that right now, and I'm sure that people have other things on their mind, and I'm hoping that some folks are listening to the conversation here, and you're thinking, well, how involved in that? Well, is that? Well, it's really not. It will not take you more than a minute or two, and I expect that you could even do it while you're listening if you want to do it online. And many folks would say, yeah, you know, that's on my list. Well, maybe you could just cross that item off for us this morning.
Don't put it off.
Don't put it off, and make that contribution, and it's just so important. You know, it's not all that far. We can look down the road and we can see the end of our fiscal year. It's actually not that far. It's the end of June. And on that day, we need to have in the bank the money that will pay for next year's programs. We're always thinking ahead. That's why we set these periodic goalpost that we want to reach throughout the year. And that's why we're doing this right now.
Yeah. And I mean, right now I work, you know, on the TV side of things. We're planning the month of, well, actually we've planned the month of April. I will be moving on to May anytime now. And so June is coming right around the corner and beyond that. So, yeah, we hope you'll call right now, 217-244-9455. And thanks.
I'd like to introduce once again the guest for this hour of Focus. Bharath Gopalaswamy is Visiting Associate Director in the Program in Arms Control, Disarmament, and International Security here on the campus of the University of Illinois. It's a program that's been around quite a while, and we've over the years had many folks involved with the ACTUS that here on this campus and then people they have brought, as is the case with our guest, our other guest here, Victoria Sampson. She's a Washington Office Director for the Secure World Foundation. They have a website, swfound.org, so if you'd like to find out what they are all about, you can go there and take a look at it. Before becoming involved with the Secure World Foundation, she served as a senior analyst for the Center for Defense Information and has been dealing with these kinds of issues in her professional work for a while now. Questions welcome as we continue to talk about space security, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. As I said, you know, back at the beginning of the conversation, I expected that If you say space security, what people really are going to think of is militarization of space and concerns that weapons might be placed in space, either anti-satellite weapons or things that are focused on the ground, or also that things in space would be targets. And I think that it perhaps not so much in the Obama administration, but in the Bush administration, I think that the Pentagon articulated very clearly a kind of a policy that said, we consider space to be part of the battlefield, and as such, we feel it's incumbent on us to secure that ground. That's literally, it's the high ground, which is what you want, the ultimate high ground. And I'm not sure that I've heard anything quite like that during the Obama administration. Where now does that idea stand, that people in the U.S. military say we need to be prepared to defend and operate in space for military purposes?
Well, the military still believes that we need to ensure that we have continued access and reliable use of space, and their guidance does talk about deterring aggression. But it's been really interesting. Over the past 15 years, there's been a tremendous change in how the military looks at space, and that's really been within, I would say, the past 5 or 6 years. Definitely under the Bush administration, there was the idea of having, you know, unfettered access to space, possibly doing space-based missile defense. That never got off the ground. But the military over the past 5 years has really changed how it looks at space, and this is not necessarily due to the administration, even though the Obama administration has had a heavy emphasis in its guidance documents on international cooperation, responsible use of space, sustainable use of space. So that certainly helps. But I think with the United States military, what the concern is, they realize that if we can have anti-satellite weapons and interfere with other people's satellites, that means other people can interfere with ours. Mm-hmm. And not as I was talking to one military officer, and he said, you know, my concern is even not necessarily someone deliberately targeting one of our satellites. What happens if, say, India and Pakistan get into a shooting match and start shooting at each other's satellites? Nothing to do with us, not intended to hit the United States. That debris is going to affect us no matter what. So that's really where they realize that just the way it is, the way that space has become more congested, contested, and competitive, the space environment has changed, and we need to change how we look at it. And, you know, the United States military has said we need to have norms of behavior, responsible use of space, which is interesting because you don't necessarily associate that with DOD. Yeah, but they really recognize, again, it's to our benefit to have that sort of mentality out there.
I think you briefly mentioned that point about international cooperation. What the Obama administration has recognized that this is a task that they cannot do it alone. And that is on a number of levels. That is on a technical, political, and legal level. And they have emphasized international cooperation as one of their key areas in the National Space Strategy document that was released in 2011. They stressed and emphasized on space on that document. The other type of attacks that you would see in space are not the way that you think it's an anti-satellite weapon taking a satellite off. There are also other soft kill methods. For example, when the Iranian revolution in June 2009, the protests after the elections.
After the presidential election,
after the elections. Yeah. There were a couple of European satellites. I think BBC was being jammed by some unknown party based out of Iran. It was attributed, the signal was attributed, traced back to Iran. But you do not know who that, whether it was a state that was acting or that was a private non-state actor, an individual citizen who is sitting down and jamming these satellites. So these are challenges that cannot be acted by. Even if you recognize the source of the attack, you don't have any legal authority to go and zero down on the attacker. So this is something that you, this is something that has to be done only in the form of international cooperation and consensus in the international community to prevent these types of interferences.
Right, and just building onto that, I mean, in terms of international cooperation, the United States military tracks these space debris objects. They didn't necessarily start out doing that. What they were starting out doing was to monitor, back in the Cold War, if there are any Soviet ICBMs coming over the pole. So that's kind of, they're pointed that way. So all of our SSA, our space situational awareness sensors, are in the Northern Hemisphere. We don't have any in the Southern Hemisphere. So when debris goes over the Southern Hemisphere, we're having issues. Mm. So one of the ways in which international cooperation is saying, okay, Australia, how about we put something down there and cooperate with you on this? So that's kind of an easy way to go about doing this. But it's one of those things that it's going to take some time just because objects up in space are very sensitive. Every country has some satellites they don't like to acknowledge are up there. And I find that fascinating because there's a whole amateur satellite observation community called CSAT, where people in their backyards can actually, they track stuff that's launched. They track quote-unquote secret objects. If you're launching something, people are going to see it and they're going to know about it. They may not know what it is or what its purpose is, but it's going to be there. And so in my opinion, it's just foolish to deny knowing about it because you're only hurting yourself.
Yeah, it seems like that, again, we talked earlier about the fact that within the EU there has been this proposal for develop a code of conduct for space, and the United States has kind of signed on for that. But there's a long way between talking about it and actually having something. And I think that also at the same time, people have argued that really there we ought to be talking also about some way to provide greater transparency and information sharing among spacefaring nations so that people will be willing to say, okay, this is what we're doing, this is what we got, this is what we have done, this is what we're planning. But at the same time, you have to recognize that nations are simply not going to want to lay out everything that they're doing on the table in the way that you might like if you're going to have true transparency like that.
Right. Yeah. Talking about EU, I couldn't resist. I was reading an article on the BBC yesterday, and apparently the EU farmers who get subsidies for their land and are not properly implementing them, the Europeans are using satellites to verify what they're doing. And they are fined if they're not. So talking about transparency and verification, I think this is I couldn't resist sharing this with you. You're right. The countries have to declare in advance about what they're doing and what kind of space activities they are engaged in. What is important is to put space in a broader geopolitical context. Mm-hmm. Space is one of the issues that countries have disagreements with each other. It's not the only issue. And when putting these into, when you look at the big picture, that's where you get distorted images of what I share, what you share. Hey, you did this in the past. You did not do it properly. And also remember, space is agreements and transparency and confidence building measures. The verification issues that are traditionally associated with other arms control regimes do not necessarily apply the same way in space. For example, what to verify, what to look for, who to verify, who is it mandated with, how to verify. are all complicated questions you need to ask.
Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, space may be a vacuum, but the politics of space do not occur in a vacuum. And it's always important, particularly, I think, within the defense community, space tends to be shunted off to its own side. You know, it's just civil space or space exploration. Those are certainly parts of an important spectrum, but they're not the only parts. There's a whole range of issues that, you know, political and security concerns that affect how you use space.
Yeah, and I'm sure that we should only expect this to become more of an issue. It's going back to the earlier point that there would have been a time when there were two spacefaring nations. There was the United States, there was the Soviet Union. But the fact is that now, even though not everyone has launch capability, there are a lot of nations that have a presence in space. And I think that we should only expect that over time, that number is going to grow. So this problem of crowding of space, how does the resource get used? How do we mitigate the problem of debris creation? If it is true that, you know, if I wanted to launch a satellite and I had the money to do it, I guess I could. Seems that this the problem of space sustainability, using that resource sustainably, is only going to get bigger.
Right. I mean, as you said, we used to have just two countries that really had access to space. Now we have 10 countries that have their own satellite launch capabilities. Now we have over 70, that's 70 entities that own or operate satellites. And more countries are getting involved because they see it as a way in which to develop technical capabilities within their own countries. They see it as a way in which to help their countries develop. And let's be honest, it's a prestige program in the United States. It's a prestige program elsewhere. And so other countries want to get in on the action. And that's not necessarily a bad thing, but you do have to realize it's complicated, and you need to make sure there are a variety of opinions and viewpoints represented.
Mm-hmm. As she said, it, there are two countries that were there. There are now 10 countries with launch capabilities, more than 70 entities, and almost all of us are consumers of space in one way or the other. So at some levels, the responsibility is also on us to how do we address this issue to our local policy-making organs or bodies, mm-hmm. How this problem can be also tackled from bottoms-up approach.
And is there any effort like that? There certainly must be non-governmental organizations that are interested in space, like yours, organizations of scientists, people who are interested in astronomy, people who are interested in space exploration, that might be in some position to do that.
Yes and no. There are, within the arms control community, space is not really a popular subject. It's kind of saying, well, we'd rather do nuclear or, you know, something like that. And then you have, as you said, kind of the space exploration types and the space science types, you think, yay, space is great, you know, go space. So you don't really have much of a discussion about how to go about doing it. So it's difficult to look at the policy concerns. It's been a real challenge, but I think it's something that's well worth undertaking.
Well, we thank Will Radio for this because you're giving us a platform to make this issue aware among the local community. Yes, I've worked with Secure World for the last 4 years, and I think they're doing a great job in keeping this issue alive on the table and persistence and going along with this issue. And I think ACTUS is engaged in this issue. This is one of my areas of focus while at time at ACTUS, and I think we need to make some of our people aware about what this issue really is and make students interested in this issue to pursue it as careers.
We are going to have to stop at that point as we have here come to the end of the time. I want to say thanks very much to our guests, Bharath Gopalaswamy. He is Visiting Associate Director at the Program in Arms Control, Disarmament, and International Security here at University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. And joining us as well, Victoria Sampson, the Washington Office Director for the Secure World Foundation. And if you are interested in finding out more about her organization and some on this issue, swfound.org. That's their website.
Yeah, thank you very much for having us.
Yeah, thanks very
much
for being
here.
And I guess I'll also mention just very quickly again that Victoria will be giving a talk at noontime today dealing with these issues, sponsored by the folks in ACTUS, 356 Armory on the U of I campus. Anybody who would like to stop by should feel welcome. And again, thanks very much.
Thank you.